Well, good morning. Good to see y'all. We're working through a series of sermons. We're going to look at the Ten Commandments and try to look at how the Ten Commandments relate to today and try to find contemporary connections there and think about how they relate. Some of the Ten Commandments are going to be very easy for you to see, oh yeah, that's still relevant, or yeah, I can see why that would still be pretty important for us to think about. Don't kill or don't lie, those kinds of things. But I think today might be one that people would be tempted to say, well, that doesn't really apply to us anymore. That was a problem they had then, but we've kind of grown past it. And what it is, at some level, it's a chronological snobbery. C.S. Lewis used that phrase, that it's a chronological snobbery that we believe that the people who lived a long time ago, they were savages and they didn't understand what we understand and they made mistakes that we don't make. And we know that in the beginning, ancient history, people worshipped idols, and we don't see that as much, not the same way, you know, where people would make a little shrine and worship idols. There's other countries, of course, that would do that. If you went to India, you might find millions and millions of little shrines and temples and pagodas and different things. But in America, we don't see it that same way. And we might be tempted to think, well, we've just grown beyond that. But I think that's the wrong way to look at idols, and probably the wrong way to look at the Ten Commandments, and maybe even the wrong way to look at sin more generally. I think one of the qualities of sin in your life, in my life, is that we usually don't see it. And when we do see it, when there's moments where it does kind of creep out there, and we, oh yeah, that's a problem, it's very easy for us to defend it, or excuse it, minimize it, or maybe even try to protect it. It's a weird thing, and it's seen all the time if you start looking for it, but especially like in marriage, you can see it. A husband or wife get into an argument about something, maybe the husband challenges the wife about some area, you know, hey, you ought to do this different. It doesn't really matter what this is. You ought to work a little harder on this. I've noticed some laziness in your life on this area. You need to fix that. And most of the time, not always, the person who's being challenged that way, husband or wife, doesn't really matter, they don't take that. Hey, you know what? That's important for me to think about. I'll reflect on that and try to get better in the weeks to come. Normally what you do when challenged on that sort of thing is to turn it right back around on the other person. You know, like as an example, a husband and wife are going someplace and they're running a little late. They didn't get out of the house in time. And the husband says to the wife, you know, maybe if you'd get ready a little earlier, we could leave on time. And she says, well, maybe if you got off the couch and helped around with the kids, I could get done a little earlier. And what's interesting with those kinds of arguments is that neither of them really deny what their problem is. I mean, the husband's not going to say, hey, you know what, you're right. I do sit down on the couch too much. I wish I didn't watch as much sports. And he's going to say that. What he'll say is, well, maybe I wouldn't need rest so bad on the weekends if you didn't complain. So, you know, it just always escalates a little further. And it's very hard not to look at your own thing. It's very easy to turn it back on the other person. And I think we can do that with idolatry too. I think if an alien were to come to this world and observe us from a distance, he would notice that as a species, as people, we worship. It's something that we do. And whether it be church or religion, but even if an alien, like I said, if some foreign UFO came down and just observed humans and saw how we do at ball games or at concerts or at political rallies, it's not unbelievable if the alien would say, yeah, you're worshiping. I mean, everybody's facing the stage. You're all bowing and singing at the same time. I mean, it's worship. Oh, no. What you saw there was a football game, and you're trying to explain how that's not at all what you're doing while you have your face painted. And I don't know what you thought you saw there, but that's not that at all. And what we find, if you just try to take an observation of people, is that it's very easy for this obsessiveness, you know, whatever word you want to call for it, you know, how a person can totally empty their life out in the pursuit of one hobby or one goal or one thing or one objective to the exclusion of everything else. I mean, it happens all the time. And you wouldn't think of that as idolatry, right? You wouldn't think, well, I'm not worshiping like a little idol on a stand. But you've kind of tilted your whole life after this one thing. And it's that, really, that God's warning us about in the first two commandments. So just to kind of again review the commandments. First commandment was, number one, no other gods before me. And the second commandment is this on the screen here. He says, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven, on earth above, or on the earth below, or beneath, or the waters below. And you would think, if that's the only verse you had there, that God's against art. But that's the wrong way to look at it. God's not against image making in general. In fact, when the temple is built, he gives specific instruction for certain sculptures or artwork in it. He'll command Moses to make a statue. I mean, there's different times where God's not against art. It's the second sentence coming up that defines this first one. And the second sentence is, you shall not bow down to them or worship them. So he says, I don't want you to build something, create something out of your own hands or your own mind, and build this thing and then make that your idol and bow down and worship it. He says, I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. And when you're reading the word jealous there, you want to think exclusive. God's willing to enter a relationship with us, but he's only willing to do it if it's an exclusive relationship. You're not going to put anything between us and God. God's going to be our first and our only. First commandment is, have no other gods before me. The second command, I don't want you to make an artificial God, create some artificial God. And he says the consequences for that sort of thing are long. And here's what he says. He says, I'm going to punish the children for the sins of the parents of the third or fourth generation of those who hate me. And again, notice that jealous God thing, and he uses the word hate. It's all or nothing with God. Either I'm first place or that's the language he's using here. You know, if you have an idol in front of me, if you start worshiping this other thing, it's like you hate me, God says. It's either exclusive or not at all. That's the deal he's offering to the Israelites. He says, and if you choose to go a different direction, there's going to be punishment for that. And you can look at it like God's in heaven throwing lightning bolts down and see that kind of punishment. Or you can look at it like, and we see this, you know, the children of an angry person often are angry people who produce angry children. And we see the sin in a family just passed down. And things as a kid, you swore, when I'm an adult, when I have my own family, I'll never do that. And then you do that, whatever that thing is. And the sin of the father or the mother can linger to the point where if a husband were to tell his wife, you know, you're just like your mother, that's not always helpful. It doesn't always, not always received well. And you need to learn these things. You need to, because that's how sin works. But he goes on, I got the three dots there at the end. It's not his last, he says, but I'm going to show love to 1,000 generations who love me and keep my commandments. So the blessings for following God far, far, far outweigh, he says, the curse of going the other direction. And I want to talk about all this through the sermon, but that's the second commandment. No idols. I don't want you to bow down and worship. I'm a jealous God. And if you choose to go the other direction, you're going to feel it for generations. But if you choose to come after me, you're going to be blessed for 1,000 generations. That's the second commandment. And I just wanted to kind of talk through that and see if we can't figure out what he's trying to say there. The first thing, when you think about an idol and trying and picturing a god in a different form, let's think about that. In the New Testament, we understand that Jesus is that image of God, right? And so it's common in the New Testament era to represent Jesus with a symbol. And nobody sees anything wrong with that, whether it's a cross, you know, it's an easy symbol of Jesus. So the fish, sometimes you see that because the early disciples were fishermen, and the word ichthus, which is a Greek for fish, you can make a acronym out of that, and each of the letters, I stands for Jesus, and Jesus, the X stands for Christos, Theos for God, and Soter, Savior. So Ichthus, Jesus Christ, God and Savior. And they made that their symbol, and they used the fish. You saw the fish drawn, you saw, oh, it's Jesus. That's what we're talking about there. So early on, I mean, like in the first couple hundred years, Christians who met one another on the road might let one another know they're Christians by making the sign of the cross. Catholic Church still does that. Protestant Church, not as much. But that's where it came from, and you just make this symbol, let the other guy know you're a Christian. An easy way to let somebody know where you stand. And these symbols became pretty important. In the Old Testament, before Jesus, you don't hardly ever see the people of Israel do that at all. And they were trying so hard to obey this commandment, you know. We don't want to create any symbols to talk about God. The biggest symbol in the Old Testament about God was a throne, an empty throne. The Ark of the Covenant, they would ride on the poles, and it's like how a king gets carried on the litter. That was the throne for God. He rests on the angels and on the top of that thing. And this empty throne was the symbol of God. And they tried very hard not to make a symbol, because their thinking was, whatever symbol we make, it won't show the whole picture. You're going to get some picture of God, but you're not going to understand all of it. And to kind of illustrate that this morning, I asked some friends of mine in California to send me a little jar of the Pacific Ocean. So I have that. Somebody in first service said that they feel like summer's not started until they put their feet in the ocean. So if you're one of those, I can help you today. You'll have to do it 1 foot at a time, but we can work on that if that helps you out. You know, when you think about the ocean here, one person might say, one of my goals, bucket list, you know, I want to see the Pacific Ocean before I die. Here you go. Mission accomplished, right? Well, no. If you've ever been to the ocean, this is not at all. I mean, it may be the ocean, but it's not the ocean, right? That's not how that works. I mean, being at the ocean is being on the beach and the sand and to hear it, right? To hear the ocean, to hear the waves crashing in, to go out there and get knocked around by the waves, to the seaweed and the little bit of a risk, you know, in the ocean, the jellyfish or something like that, stingrays. The ocean is vast. To sit there on the beach and all you can see is water, the whole horizon. You know, the ocean is so much bigger than this. And this could be the ocean. I mean, it is just the water. You know, it really is the water, but it's not the ocean. That's kind of how the Jews felt like idols were with God. When you take an idol and you say, well, this is what God is, you're just not explaining it very well. And it really doesn't matter what idol you take. You're limiting who God is. You're not explaining it well. Now, I do think as you get older in faith, God is constantly breaking your perception of him. You'll think you have God all figured out, and then he'll do something. And, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't understand God at all. You know, when I first became a Christian, I thought God was maybe the man upstairs who's going to give me what I need when I need it. And then he doesn't always. Sometimes God lets me go through the valleys. I wish that wasn't true, but it is. And if my picture of God didn't allow for that, then I'd have to give up on faith altogether. So my picture of God got a crack or two in it. And I had to get a new picture of God. Try to understand that sometimes God lets me go through a hard thing because he's trying to build me into something. I would have this perception that God won't ever give me more than I can handle. You know, maybe a well-meaning Christian told me that once. God won't ever give you more than you can handle. And then one day you go through more than you can handle. You know? Feels like you can't even get a good breath of air. You're so nervous and frustrated and scared. And again, there's this temptation to give up on faith altogether. I guess I didn't know anything about God. And God is, there's a crack or two in my facade, and then he builds it back together. God's always been doing that to me. I'm 58. I expect he'll do that to me still. Maybe right to the very end. In fact, I think when I get to heaven, I think I'll still be learning. And I think when we've been there for 10,000 years, we'll just be beginning to sing about his amazing grace, and we'll just be beginning to understand how big God is. It really is like the ocean. And there's just no small picture I can have of that that's going to take me where I want to go. The closest we can get is Jesus. Now, the Bible talks about Jesus. It says that he's our mediator. He's the one intermediary between us and God. And it calls him the image of the invisible God. Like he's what God looks like. If you could look at him, that empty throne, this is who should be sitting on that empty throne. This is Jesus. But even with Jesus, he's hard to explain completely. Just when you think you've got Jesus all figured out, you'll read some story in the New Testament. That doesn't sound right. I don't know why he did that. That doesn't make sense. And you'll have to think again. And I think that's part of why the idol command is there. Part of why the idol command is there is because God is so much bigger than whatever little box you try to put him in. And part of being humble and part of being submissive is just realizing that. Part of the reason why God gave the command about idols is that idols have a way of expecting something back. I mean, anytime you worship anything, it expects something back. When you worship God, I mean, you're giving your heart to God. You're trying to sing with enthusiasm. You're trying to give with sacrificial enthusiasm. You're pushing yourself, right? That's part of worship. And when you worship God, whatever you offer to God is going to be paid back tenfold. I don't mean like a health wealth thing, but when you really, I mean, no one has ever come to the end of their life and say, "I just loved God too much." Now, they might get to the end of their life and say, "I loved wild turkey too much." That might happen. Or, "I loved the wrong people. I wish I hadn't done that." That could happen. Or, "I wish I hadn't wasted all my time here or there." I mean, that could happen. But you're never going to get to the end of your life and say, "I just loved God too much." I mean, that always feeds the soul. That always takes you where you want to go. That always keeps pushing you. But these other idols that we want to choose, they have a way of demanding something too. And what they take from you is slavery. Jesus talks about that. He says, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. And these little crutches that we try to lean on, they have a way of taking back. We can't totally get away from it. And I think people don't realize it at first when they get into it. And then it grabs them. I didn't tell this story at first service. My very favorite story, my very favorite preacher story. I get joy out of telling it. I will say, as an old man, I no longer care if people laugh at my jokes. If I get joy out of telling it, I just tell it anyway. And this story is very much that way for me. So just bear with me. It'll be over soon. I got to hear a guy named Gary Richmond, and he talked about, he was a zookeeper, that was his job, and he had all these awesome stories about monkeys and giraffes and elephants and dealing with these giant animals at the zoo. But my favorite story, and it's weird that it's my favorite story because I hate snakes, was a story about the snake house. And he said one of his first jobs as a veterinarian with a veterinarian assistant was to go to the veterinarian to the snake house. They had a cobra who had a scar on its eye, and so when it would shed its skin, that wouldn't come off, and they'd have to grab the snake and cut that off, which would make me not want to be a zoo veterinarian if that's what I had to do, but they would have to go do it. And so it's a big deal. Every time they had to do it, they'd get all the guys, and they'd go to the hallway behind the deal, and they'd open up the cage, and the snake would slither back there and be real angry because they're territorial. This is my cage. You can't get here. And there'd be the veterinarian in front of the cage. He's just out in front of it. And the cage opens up about 3 foot off the ground, and the snake can get about 3 foot off the ground. So he's about head level looking at you. And then there's a couple of veterinarian guys here helping out. And then Gary says, "I was way back in the corner if they needed me." And the snake launches out of the cage. He said the snake roared. I don't know that cobras roar, but that does make it more terrifying in my head to think that they do. So that part's what I remember. If you look it up later on Wikipedia and find that snakes don't roar, don't tell me, because it's better in my head if they do. But the cobra roars and launches out. Veterinarian, just as cool as the other side of the pillow, grabs him on the back of the head, puts the snake on the ground. The other two guys come in so the snake won't thrash around, and they're holding him there, and they start doing the procedure. Well, at the end of the procedure, it's been 10 or 15 minutes of cutting and working on the snake, and the snake's ticked off, you know, mad. And the veterinarian says to Gary Richmond, who's telling the story, "Won't you go get as many paper towels as you can and fold them into a little ball?" And so he does it, comes back. He's got like a softball-sized ball of paper towels. He says, "Check your hands out real careful. Any cuts or scratches?" And he goes, "No, looks pretty good. I mean, really look. Any open wounds at all on your hands?" "No, it looks really good." "Okay, put the ball in the snake's mouth." And he's just, you know, "What? Yeah, just put it in." So he, gentle as he can, gets up there to the snake, immediately starts chewing on it, and it goes yellow with venom. And the veterinarian's talking about it. He said, it's just important that we empty their venom sacs as much as we can. A cobra out in the wilderness can drop an elephant if it gets a good bite. If you could spread it out, you'd kill 100 men with a cobra, one bite." And we've been doing this for 15 minutes. My hands are tired. I'm starting to cramp up a little bit. This snake's really wearing me out. And if he bites me, I want to make sure the sacks are empty. And Richmond says, I'm backing up to the back. I want to get as far away from the snake as they can. And at the end, it all goes fine. They get him back in the cage, and it's fine. Until 6 months later when they do it again. And the veterinarian's talking to Richmond. He said, these big snakes are easy to catch if you know how. They're just hard to let go of. That's what sin is. That's what sin is. It's easy to catch. Any moron can get into a hole. It's just hard to get loose once you get in. And again, I don't have to tell you that. You know it. How much evidence do you have in your life that that's true? And that's what idolatry is. And when we allow these things to kind of get on us, they enslave us. We don't even really remember how we got started. I was just flirting, or I don't know, it was just friendly banter, or I don't know, it's just one thing, and then all of a sudden it's more than that. So that's the second reason. First reason, any idol limits God. Second reason, it has a way of enslaving. And it's worth thinking about, I guess, before I leave this here. Well, why would anybody choose it then? You know, people through all space and time have chosen that. Why would anybody choose an idol if that's the deal? Several years ago, when I was a young man, really, from the time I was born until I was about 35 or so, always had a hard time going to sleep at night. Always did. I mean, I could be awake at 1 or 2 in the morning, couldn't turn my head off. It just forever and ever. Can now. I could take a nap right here this morning if I needed to, but then I couldn't for a long, long time. And if you remember, those of you who are my age or a little older, the offerings on late night television pretty thin in the 80s and 90s. Wasn't a lot to watch in the early morning hours. I don't know if there is now or not. I'm sound asleep, but back then wasn't a lot of options. And so you'd find yourself watching infomercials at night. Little late-night, half-hour TV commercials about things. And one of them comes on, and it's advertising Jesus the doll. And it's this little plush Jesus, little scrunched-up Jesus there. And it shows an old woman hugging it at night with the thunderstorms outside the window. And if you just need that little extra push, you know, a little extra presence of God, we can send you Jesus the doll. And he had his little nail-printed hands there. And a machine washable. And if you were Jewish, they could send you Moses the doll. And I guess there were several other things they could send you. And what a neat thing that could be. If I just need a little extra something there. And I'm sure they sold, you know, to people like me. I didn't buy one, but I'm sure there were guys like me who couldn't get to sleep and thought, hey, that could be the answer. Right there, Jesus the doll. And the big benefit of Jesus the doll is that he doesn't really make any demands out of you. He just sort of lays there. And if you get tired of dealing with Jesus the doll, you just put him in the drawer, right? I think that's the temptation for idolatry, is it gives me something, or I think it will, and if I don't want to listen to it, I don't have to. I can just lean into it when I want to. I can manipulate it, right? I can feed it a little if I want a blessing, or I can try to figure it out, and it, for the most part, just leaves me alone. That's what I think. Tim Keller said, an idol is anything that's more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and your imagination more than God. Anything that you seek to give you what only God can give. Things like security. Money is a fine thing, but if I lean on money for my security, I'm bound to be disappointed. Career is a good thing. In fact, there's a lot of good things that are good things in the right perspective, but if it becomes too much, like a lot of Christians even, if we're being honest, will make their family an idol. You know, they'll shortcut things that they should be doing for God, and they'll defend it by saying, I'm doing this for my family. Yeah, we can't be at church for 3 weeks, but that's because of family. Or yeah, we won't be able to really participate in this thing or that thing, but my family comes first. And again, that sounds like a righteous thing, to put family ahead of every other last thing in the world. It does. And I know some people who are so proud of their family, and not just proud of their family, but proud that they're the leader of that important family. Constantly putting pictures out on Facebook or bragging about how their kid is doing so well. What's the problem with making an idol out of your family? Well, they're broken. Just like you are. And sooner or later, they're going to let you down. They're going to forget important things, or they're going to say something they maybe they don't mean, or maybe they do mean it, they just wish they hadn't said it out loud. They're going to hurt you. There's going to be moments where you're going to say, I wish that, you're going to wonder if you're a good parent. You're going to wonder if you are even doing it right. There's going to be times where if you make your family your idol, where you have to show up at church and everybody says, how you doing? Doing great. And you're not doing great. You argued the whole way in. Or worse, everybody's just silent the whole way in. And again, a family is a great thing. What a gift from God that is. But if you make it the ultimate thing, a career is a great thing. To go out there and work and make this world a little better, however you do it, whether it's repairing engines or building bridges or a nurse or a doctor or you go out there and you make the world a little better, that's an awesome thing. It's an honorable thing to work real hard and give your blood and your sweat and your time to something, to build something, whether you're making $18 an hour or $1 billion, it doesn't matter. It just for you to improve this world is a worthwhile thing. But if you make it the ultimate thing, well, it's just going to let you down. Sooner or later, you won't get the promotion, or you won't get the achievement, or you won't get the financial. Sooner, money won't pay out like you thought it would. Sooner or later, you'll have employees who don't treat you right. I mean, sooner or later, it'll break because it is broken. God talks about that in the book of Jeremiah. He says, my people have committed two sins. They've forsaken me, he says, the spring of living water. And they've dug their own cisterns, broken cisterns that can't hold water. That's what idolatry is. And even when we take good things and elevate them, and we worship them, it hurts us. Two weeks ago, we did a week of camp, and we talked about joy the whole week. The easiest definition for joy is joy is hope. You're not stuck. This can get better. If you're in a marriage that's not what you want it to be, you're not stuck. This can change. If you're in a family that's not going like you want it to go, you're not stuck. If in your own imagination, in your own heart, you're just fearful and fretting all the time, you're having such a hard time going where you're not stuck. Joy is hope, and joy and hope are found in Christ. He can change things. God still is changing things. And when you dig real deep into him, and when you drink real deep of that well, you're going to go someplace. It's just easy to give up. It's just easy to quit. Right after God gave these commands, these Ten Commandments, Moses comes down and tells the people, they hear the Ten Commandments, and then he's gone back up the mountain, and he's getting all the other stuff. God's given commands about what the temple will look like, and he's given commands about what it means to be clean, to worship him. He's given commands about, he's trying to build a people. And there's all these laws and rules that will be eventually codified. This is the law of Moses, and God is dictating this to Moses, and he's on top of the mountain with God. And when God first sets on that mountain, when he first sets up there, it's terrifying. The people don't even want to leave their tents. They're all staying inside, and you go talk to God. We don't want anything to do with it, you know, and they're so scared to get anywhere near the mountain. You know, God, you do your thing, God and Moses, and let us know how it turns out. And Moses goes, and days start to pass, and they eventually come out of their tents. And they start living life again. They just get used to God being up there, which sounds crazy, but it's what we do. I grew up on a farm, and in the fall when they were picking corn, the grain bins, the furnaces, the dryer fans were on all the time. And at first, it's all you could, you just noticed it. You noticed it all the time. The dryer fans was so loud when you went to sleep, it's the last thing you heard, and it's just roaring in the house there, and it just was constant. And you got to where you didn't notice it. You're at the dinner table talking to your brother. Pass the salt, you say, and you don't even know that you're doing that because you're all used to it. No one thinks anything about it. It's just that kind of thing. And one of my kids brought a friend home from college, and they spent the weekend with us, and they said they had a hard time sleeping at our house because it wasn't noisy enough. They needed more racket to go to sleep. So, sorry, we can't help you with that. It's weird what you get used to, right? And they got used to God up there thundering around. And the people say, you know, this is taking too long. This guy Moses went up there. We don't know what's happened to him. And they start saying, we need a God that we can manage. We need the ocean in a jar. Jesus the doll. That's what we need. And they go to Aaron and they say, what can you do for us? He said, well, bring me your earrings and I'll see what I can do. And he crafts them a bull, a golden calf. And it probably goes to the gods of Egypt. It might go to Baal. Baal was sometimes worshipped with a bull, and it could go to that, but probably the gods of Egypt. And but they still call it Yahweh. They still call the gold. Aaron presents it. Look here, Israel. Here's your God, your Yahweh, who brought you out of Egypt. And it says the people decided to immediately start getting drunk and carousing. Indulge in revelry is what the NIV says. And probably a sexual thing. And as soon as that starts, God stops talking on the hill, on the mountain. Go back down, Moses. They don't want it. I'm giving you all these things and they don't want it. They want to control it themselves. They don't want to follow me. And you can read it later. It's Exodus 32. There's this long conversation between God and Moses. Moses has to talk God out of giving up on us. And people just haven't changed that much. We'd like God to take care of us and to bless us and to help us get along, but then we want to do whatever we want to do. And when we chase these different idols, we find that they don't really satisfy, and they don't really take us where we want to go. And we come back humbly to God. God, I can't believe I got off on this again. And he'll take you back. And my agenda with the sermon today is to help you see that we do that, that we still do that. That's not an old thing. It's a thing. It's how people are. And I want to challenge you not to settle for a cheap imitation of God. I want to challenge you to seek his face, to really come after him, to pray and ask God to move and to challenge yourself. I mean, the question's behind me. What gives you a sense of security? Where's your security? Is it in God? Is it just in money? Is it just in your title? Is it just in having perfect kids or a perfect house? Perfect marriage? What gives you your sense of identity? Why do you think that you've made it in life? Why do you think you're doing good? Is it because of your title? Because of the car you drive? Is it dependent on admiration? Whether that be Facebook likes or all the employees at work saying how great you are? What eats up most of your time and your talent and your money? And there's nothing wrong with spending time, talent, and money on frivolous things. It's good occasionally to go to the lake and just have a fun day. It's good to go on vacation, and it's nothing wrong with, I mean, it's nothing wrong. I'm not wanting you to have no fun. There's nothing wrong with letting loose occasionally. There's nothing wrong with doing things that aren't religious. But, I mean, what eats up most of your time? Most of your worry? Again, you might find on some of these things that the answers aren't exactly what you want them to be. And that's not a sign that you necessarily need to fix that immediately. It's just a wake-up call. I think God is the thing that satisfies. I think God is the one who satisfies. I think God is the one who can give you hope. So, last thing. I want you to picture something for me. I told you earlier, the very last part of this verse was that God says you'll be punished for 3 or 4 generations for the sin. Most of you, 90% at least, know exactly what that means. You've seen it. you do the same stupid things your dad did or your mom did, or that their dad or mom did, or that their dad or mom did. Sometimes a family can be so known for something, people in the small town will talk about it. Well, that's just like a Huddleston. You know, what else would you have done? You're just like your dad or your mom. You know, we see how it eats at us. We see how the mistakes that one group made, we just make the same thing. And we see, again, most of us, things that we said, when I become an adult, I'll never do that. And then you do that very thing. We know what that means. But that wasn't the whole promise. God says the sins chase people for 3 or 4 generations, but God says my blessings will chase people for 1,000 generations. And it's this picture in your head of your great-great-great-grandkids, and they're talking about what a mess your family used to be. Until one day, you turned it around. And you're old and gone by then, but they still remember you. You're the one who got it right. Our family was heading a bad direction, but you turned it around. I really believe that's possible. I really believe that that's still possible, and there's still hope in this world, and that gives me great joy, and I think as Christians we should access that more than we do. Let me pray for you. Dear Lord God, I just thank you for this group. As we come to this place and to the end of this service, a lot of temptation, God, to just make this the only time we check on you, just this 1 hour on Sunday, and then we don't think about it again until next week. So I pray for more. I pray, God, for more. I pray that you help us to seek you out, not just today, but every day. That, God, we make you the center focus of our lives, and that, God, we hunger and thirst for you because you can fill us up in ways that other things can't. God, I just want to ask for anybody here who wants hope, who wants joy. I pray that I've convinced them somehow that they can find that in you. And I pray, God, that you help them to run your direction. In Jesus' name, amen. As we finish up our service, there's some people on both sides who would be happy to pray with you.